Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 5th of July. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And if you can hear racing cars in the background, I apologise profusely because I'm sat by the side of the Nürburgring GP circuit, so there may be a little noise. Kev, Captain Fantastic saves the day. What do we reckon? 70 minutes of pain and a strong DR Congo, and then Harry Kane steps up. Do we need 11 Harry Kanes?
Don't know, but it was a good result. Let's put it that way. I mean, I think everybody's underestimating these African countries now. I mean, African,
100%. Yeah,
you know, African Nations Cup or whatever it is, CAF is a very strong tournament. We got by the time you listen to this, we'll know whether Egypt's through to the last 16. Unfortunately, Algeria got knocked out there by Switzerland as we record this, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Morocco? Was it Morocco knocking out? Was it Germany or something like that, or one of them?
No, that was Ivory Coast, I think, that knocked out Germany, was it not?
Yeah, but Morocco knocked out one of the top teams as well. I'm just trying to think. It was one of the favourites. But yeah, there's been some upsets, hasn't there?
Morocco knocked out Holland.
That's it.
But Morocco is much higher in the world rankings than Holland. Like, Morocco's seventh in the world.
Yeah, but I think it's just like the fact that, like, if I asked you the question, what is the highest ranked team that didn't qualify for the World Cup this year?
Who is it?
Yeah.
Probably it'd be Denmark or Italy, I would imagine.
Yeah, Italy, yeah, absolutely. But so, yeah, England survived a major World Cup scare, coming from behind to beat DR Congo 2-1, thanks to a second-half Harry Kane double, the captain's 71st and 72nd international goals, rescued an underwhelming England after Brian Chipenga's early opener, with Anthony Gordon providing both assists. Despite progressing to the last 16, Thomas Tuchel's side were far from convincing and will need a significant improvement against Mexico. So I think they said if England are going to overcome the all-conquering Mexico, you're going to need more help than this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just look at that team and they drastically miss an attacking right back, and his name is Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Totally agree. They've no fullback.
They miss him. And he didn't pick him for whatever reason. There's all sorts of speculation that he's having a relationship with one of Trent Alexander's old girlfriends or whatever. So who knows what the situation is, but... yeah, he's a glaring miss. I don't think there are, you know, do we miss Palmer? Do we miss Foden unlocking that midfield? Because we've got great players in there, but they're just, they're workhorses.
Yeah.
And if we've got anybody Kane, to actually unlock...
It's just Kane when you see the determination on his face. Like, it almost feels like one man lifts the whole team, really. And I think, as you say, you know, Captain Fantastic is a term that the British media have used. And I kind of agree. I think that it's almost like he's got the whole of the... It feels like it's a Southgate throwback. He's the man who's... He wants to deliver, doesn't he? He's got the passion. He's like, and that's what it's about, putting the England shirt on. How many players actually want to be there?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I see Bellingham as very passionate as well, to be honest with you. But other than that, yeah, you don't know. I mean, anyway, it's going to be one hell of a game in the Aztec on Sunday, isn't it? So yeah, I wonder how many people are staying up for it.
Staying up for the 1 a.m. 1 a.m. kickoff. How many people won't be going into work on Monday morning? So yeah, the other news was Nigel Farage obviously found himself under renewed scrutiny over a reported £5 million personal gift from the crypto billionaire Christopher Harbin, insisting it was an unconditional private gift, recognising his decades in politics and not a political donation or payment for influence. Farage denies any wrongdoing and says he can't be bought. The wider story is what it means for Reform UK, with Harbin also providing significant funding to the party. Reform is emerging as one of Britain's best-funded political movements, giving it the financial firepower to build local infrastructure, fight marginal seats, and mount a serious challenge to Labour and the Conservatives ahead of the next general election, albeit under increasing scrutiny over political donations and transparency. So they're saying in the British media, Kev, that this, the, all these donations. One minute he's saying it's this, next minute he's saying it's that. He's changing his story, and it could really put Reform's chances, under the kibosh. They're saying.
Who do you think's causing this problem?
Well, I think it's the Conservatives are whipping up an absolute storm. I think everybody's fueling it, and then the British media as well.
Yeah, they don't want change because they're all very comfortable in their situations in their ivory towers. And they don't want change. And if change comes, I'm not convinced Farage is the right man, but that's not the point. We need change. We need radical change. Radical change of radical policies that actually will, in effect, save Britain, because we're in a war. Internally, we're in a war. And if we don't realise that now, then you'll never realise it.
Yeah, totally agree. Anything else? What else? You're going to be leaving for home soon, as you say, aren't you? Give me sum up your 3 months in Hawaii. What have you learned about the life in the country?
Well, Hawaii is America, so don't let yourself get away from that. Yes, it has Hawaiian traditions here, but it's still basically one of the states of America. So you live in America. It's a much more expensive place than America, actually. So everything costs more because you are literally on a rock in the middle of an island, like 5 hours away from the coast of America. It's beautiful, but it's a volcanic rock, you know. I mean, we've been up to the volcano to watch it erupt. Unfortunately, we got there just as it finished. But it's erupted 3 or 4 times while we've been here. We've had an earthquake while we're here, 6.7 on the Richter scale.
How did you find that? Because I used to live in Japan and I experienced a couple of sort of similar sort of magnitude.
Fortunately, I was lying in bed and basically just the whole thing shook. And I thought the kids were messing about upstairs because we're in a wooden building. It's not exactly structurally strong. And I was like, what's going on? And they were like, no, because they were lying down in their beds as well. I just said, right, stay where you are. But for now, and then it stopped shaking and they came down. Beautiful, like the Pacific Ocean is amazing. You know, you can see lots of fish, different things, dolphins, turtles. You know, I was swimming in the surf and the turtle was swimming past my feet. Unfortunately, I stood on one as well, which wasn't so good. But it moved pretty fast once I stood on it. I didn't see it, so I put my foot on it. And before I actually put any pressure on it, it zoomed away. Yeah, no, the beaches are amazing. The weather is so constant. It's a bit boring in a way, because it's just like hot and sunny all the time. Yeah. And then you get a bit of rain every so often. But the rest of the time, hot and sunny. And the whole island is amazing. There are different parts of the island that we went through. And it's hard to explain. It's definitely worth a touristy visit here.
Yeah,
definitely. I'd recommend anybody come and see it. This is what's classed as the Big Island. It's not Honolulu. It's the Big Island Kona. And
Okay, well, we've got an action-packed show. Let's move on to our first guest this week. We're joined by Oliver Friesen, CEO of Guardian Metal Resources, following the release of a standout pre-feasibility study for the Pilot Mountain Tungsten Project in Nevada, one of the most advanced tungsten development projects in the United States. With robust economics and growing strategic importance for U.S. defense and critical mineral security, we'll discuss what this milestone means and the key steps towards production targeted in 2028. So welcome back, Oliver. How's life?
Yeah, it's going well, Phil. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Busy. But yeah, I mean, obviously I've sat down and digested the PFS, but just tell us more about the main takeaways from that PFS, please, Oliver.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main takeaways are just the headline numbers on the economic side of things. You know, I think ultimately, you know, you boil it down and you look deeper in the PFS and there's a lot of really fantastic takeaways. But at the end of the day, the main takeaway is 1 year payback, you know, 60% IRR and just under $600 million NPV at 8% disk case pricing. So those are fantastic economics. You know, the security of supply here, the geopolitical angle here is super important. But a lot of financial investors look at the headline numbers and they certainly are very impressive for this project.
Yeah. And what do you believe are the biggest value drivers that the market may still be overlooking right now?
I think they're probably just digesting the PFS now. There's a lot in there and, you know, there's a lot of different numbers that I think a lot of analysts are kind of working through their own internal models. I think the value is obviously there. And I think once you start to really boil it down and once you kind of even look beyond the numbers a little bit, what this means for US national security, these are things that I think it's a bit hard to kind of put a number on. And what this means for the defense industrial base, right? When you look at what demand is doing domestically in the United States for the rearmament, for technology, for chips, for solar, for wind, for automotive, aerospace, you name it, and you look at the fact that it's just becoming increasingly difficult to get your hands on tungsten, and ultimately, given its unique physical properties, once you don't have it, you can't manufacture things. So I think once you kind of look beyond that, and that point really stands out, which is it's hard to put a number sometimes on what national security really means to a country like the United States. So I think the market's going to start to really understand the value proposition here. And then I think the biggest thing that's probably being overlooked, and once again, probably for good reason, is Tempe Ute, right? Tempe Ute's an asset that we think is all but as just as good as Pilot Mountain. So huge amount of value in Pilot Mountain alone. And then as we continue to get the story out and the results out from Tempe Ute, the market, I think, will finally recognize that this is not just a one asset company. This is a company with two fantastic co-flagships that can both deliver production inside of the current administration.
Yeah, and I think that is a huge accolade, Mountain potentially becoming the first new US tungsten mine in more than a decade. That's a phenomenal, as I say, an accolade. But what are the key milestones investors should watch out for over the next 12 months as you, I guess, as you move towards permitting, financing, and ultimately production?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the next 12 months are probably, well, actually not probably, they're going to be the busiest in the company's history thus far. And we've always been a very busy, active company. But now that we have a PFS, I mean, that just unlocks a lot of commercial discussions. Now, just to be abundantly clear, we've been having discussions about this asset with the government, with off-takers, with commercial partners for I would say the better part of a year. And for a lot of them, the big sort of crux was, okay, well, as soon as you have the PFS, let's chat, right? Because the PFS will tell you how much it's going to cost to build, how much tungsten you're going to produce, what is the kind of the makeup of the concentrate that you're going to ultimately be making at your project. So the commercial program really, really gets started now. And we've done a lot of good work to get kind of things prepared on that front. So that's going to really start to ramp up here. And certainly any announcements around, binding terms and things like that would be announceable. So stay tuned on kind of how we see the commercial program playing out here for this asset. And then engineering side, that's all super active right now. So further results on kind of advanced engineering, mine permitting, exploration drilling. There's a lot of exploration upside. So results around that. And then moving over to Tempe Ute, we've maintained that we want to see the tailings opportunity there move forward. We've maintained we want to see the ore stockpile opportunity move forward. We have three rigs active there right now. So it's going to be very, very busy and I would say catalyst rich sort of 9 to 12 months here and beyond as we move from this key milestone into the next key milestones, ultimately towards a construction decision.
Oliver,
Yes,
I
sir.
just take it back to the finances. I mean, the current 660 million, I think it is, of NAV is based on a much lower tungsten price than the current long tungsten price. Obviously, that's how PFSs work, conservative situations. But you had a valuation of well over $1 billion on the current tungsten price. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly flagged to the market what the economics look like at current spot price, just to give, investors a sense as to what this project could look like, a price around the current level. Now, we model it more conservatively than that and look at sort of a long-term price that we think makes sense. But yeah, it's very levered to the price of tungsten. The numbers go up pretty considerably when you plug in the spot price. But we look at the base case as that's how we model this long term, and at the base case the economics are fantastic. So yeah, both cases fantastic, but we take a more conservative view, but it's good for investors to understand what this project could potentially do at a higher tungsten price.
Yeah, and what do you see as the, I'm going to phrase, red, white, and blue premium, because there is going to be a red, white, blue premium. There is an over demand for this project, or product, I should say, in terms of the US. I mean, we look at the big defense contractors. They're going to need more and more of this tungsten, regardless of new innovations. They're going to need more and more of that. So how do you see that playing out? One, how do we see the US government getting involved more? Mm-hmm. Because they're going to want to. They're going to want to control it in some way, shape, or form. What do we think this red, white, and blue premium is likely to be?
Yeah, I think we're going to find that out in the next 6 to 9 months here, right? You know, what's unique is the fact that there's been no domestic mine production for over 10 years now. So there's been no company or mine producing, you know, red, white, and blue tungsten. So I believe there will be a premium. You know, ultimately, you know, if you're producing a con in the very mining friendly state of Nevada and shipping it, you know, somewhere in domestic United States, there's a lot of strategic and national security advantages to that. So that, I think, is something that we're going to really start to understand and get a handle on over the next kind of 6 to 9 months, 6 to 12 months, sorry, as we really, I would say, push forward commercial conversations. But for national security, it's huge, right? United States, I think what investors probably don't have a good handle on yet is what defense demand is actually going to look like here. You know, there's a lot of talk about this rearmament, the United States of America. A lot of the stockpiles of munitions, a lot of the stockpiles of critical metals are more or less depleted. And so, you know, in a government that's controlled by Donald Trump and looking to rearmer, I think what investors are going to start to understand is how much tungsten is going to be required by the defense industrial base going forward. And I don't think it's even started yet, really, because what we're seeing now is sort of conversations around, okay, who can actually start to help rebuild stockpiles, right? And obviously they're going to the normal suspects, but also speaking to groups who have manufacturing capacity that can maybe convert that over to also help support. So when you kind of add that all together, and once kind of all the ducks are in a row and they say go, well, where is that material going to come from, right? So I think we could see kind of 2027 onwards, direct defense demand in the United States really start to surprise to the upside. And at that point, you know, I think really considering there is an opportunity to have a domestic mine source, that's when I think we'll really start to recognize and see what a premium could look like for material that's being mined in the domestic United States of America.
Yeah, I mean, even the last 4 or 5 months has going to have increased the amount of tungsten required, because there have been so many missiles, so many issues, if you like, basically being used, that there is a bigger black hole than there was even the start of 2026. From the point of view of looking at the company as where is the potential initial capital coming from, obviously we've got potential grants, but what about the viability of those tailings in Tempe Ute to actually create a revenue stream within Guardian Metal?
Yeah, so we're talking about Tempe Ute specifically, and yes, there's some very unique opportunities there. You know, what I can say is that we have been very active in pursuing and pushing those opportunities forward. You know, production at Pilot Mountain, you know, the PFS lines Q4 of 2028, which is absolutely fantastic inside of this administration. But we also want to find ways to start to supply material sooner than that. And the best opportunity we have to do that is through either, you know, the legacy tailings that exist at Tempe Ute and or the ore stockpile. So those are very active work streams for us. I can't say obviously anything beyond what's in the public domain right now, but, you know, they're very active. And if and when we finalize, you know, what that looks like, we'll certainly be able to talk about that a bit more openly. But on the tailing specifically, we are drilling right now. So there's a drill rig active at Tempe Ute testing those tailings, right? We want to understand the volume of those tailings, but also the grade of those tailings. So that's a key work stream. Once we know what that looks like, we can figure out what the next steps are. But those are very active. You know, Pilot Mountain's sort of been, I would say, the asset that we've been focused on, at least publicly, for the last few weeks here, given this really important study and the fantastic economics that come out of it. But I don't want investors or listeners to think that Tempe Ute is not moving forward because of the discussions and sort of the buzz around Pilot Mountain. Tampa Ute is just as active as Pilot, right? We have a dedicated team there, a fantastic team of engineers and geologists who are dedicated to that asset day in, day out. So that is going to, I think, lead to a lot of more information that we can get out to the market on Tampa Ute and some of those earlier potential opportunities to supply material before, certainly before Q4 2028. So stay tuned on that.
Okay, my last question before I pass over to Charles, and this is sort of taking you away from the PFS.
Sure.
Originally, when you guys came, it was Golden Metal Resources. We've got Golconda and Garfield, the plan. Because I'm assuming whoever either wants to partner with you or straight, we want the tungsten in America, they don't want other small assets sitting around. So what's Golconda and Garfield?
Yeah, so we've always maintained that we want to see those assets move forward to the benefit of our existing shareholders. That's something we've maintained. So just to add to that, there's Pilot North, there's Stonewall, there's Kibby, there's more than just the two of them in terms of non-core. What I can say is that we are pushing that opportunity forward right now, and we ultimately want to see something done certainly this year, whereby those assets are moving forward to the better to the benefit of existing Guardian shareholders. So I'll kind of leave it at that, but it's a very active work stream right now for us to move those forward, to find a sort of commercial solution where we achieve exactly what we've said we want to achieve. And like I said, this is something that I think investors can look forward to certainly this year, is how that's going to play out. So stay tuned on that.
Hi, Oliver. Nice to speak again.
Charles, how you doing? Good to
Yeah,
catch up again.
it's been good. Well, it's been a good 3 years with Guardian, formerly Golden, for both of us.
I mean, just very quickly, to think about where we started, Charles, and trying to get the IPO in. Now we have an absolutely fantastic PFS and we're moving through the next step. So happy days.
I remember tweeting out at 7p a share, this is one
There
to watch. Little
you
did you
go.
know, they don't always make it, but it's great to see when it does.
Yeah.
The thing is with pre-feasibility studies, right? A study is a study, and then you obviously you have to develop it into a mine. And so the question whenever PFS comes out for me is the CapEx number, $289 million US. And the typical route forward is debt, equity, offtakes. Obviously you're having discussions with lenders and strategic partners, but then there's that US government funding question, right? Because you've already had the $6.2 million grant from the Department of War. What would you expect the split to be between debt, equity, grant funding, JV partners, et cetera, et cetera?
So that is now a very active work stream for us right now that we have the PFS. We can really start to advance the discussions around what a financing package looks like. And it probably comes as no surprise, we're pushing this down multiple potential pathways, government being one of them, private solutions being another one. I think what's unique here is the payback, Charles. And I don't want to sit here and just say, this is what we're going to do. But the way that we look at this is, the payback period is very attractive. Base case, it's exactly 1 year. So because of that very quick payback at base case, and assuming prices hold up kind of around the level they're at, or even get down to the base case, the PFS shows that the project capital would be paid back in 1 year. So where I'm going with that is, you could probably get away with more of a debt component than an equity component,
Because it pays
because you
so
could pay it
quickly.
back very quickly, than maybe a traditional split between those two. Now, obviously, anything, any kind of award or grant, I mean, those are obviously the preferred outcome, but we're realistic about what the opportunities that currently exist on the field. And I would just say, in general, given the short payback detail in the PFS, you'd probably look at a bit more of a debt split typically than equity. But those are all ongoing. JT runs the commercial kind of program here. And so these are all very active work streams. And also another unique one, Charles, is that silver. There's an opportunity to kind of, a stream or some sort of way to monetize the silver as well. Because, in probable reserves, we have 3.5 million ounces of silver.
Which is not
And so
nothing. Yeah, at current
No,
silver
100%.
prices.
There's a lot of value there, and obviously when we look at a holistic picture to how to finance this, silver is
You go for
in the
roll through a
discussion as
streaming
well.
agreement, maybe for the silver. Yeah.
It's absolutely it's an active work stream for sure.
I mean, the other thing is obviously China's shut off exports, basically, which was,
Correct.
my prediction a few years ago, and obviously why you and others have done so well. And I think the risk is China decides, right, we'll turn the tungsten flow back on to cripple the mines again. So the US has to have a plan, right? Whether that's, potentially backing the price of tungsten for domestic mines or similar to ensure that if China does that, there's a floor beneath it. Does that make sense? This conversation must be ongoing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good example is Largo Resources. I encourage investors to have a look at the deal they just did with the US government from the Defense Logistics Agency and how that was structured. So there's certain, and MP is a good example as well as a company who got a floor price. Now, this project makes sense at much lower tungsten prices than even at the base case. But yes, I mean, I think ultimately China, if you look at geopolitically where things stand, I don't see a world in the short term where all of a sudden China says, hey, have as much tungsten as you want. I think there's a bigger story at play here.
It's a
Now,
bigger
it
game.
remains a risk for sure. And China's willing to subsidize their mines, and the rest of the world doesn't really do that typically. But yes, I think the United States government is absolutely woken up to the point that this cannot happen again, period, right? Tempaiute shut down in 83 because China flooded the market, right? So yes, I think there's been enough damage done, and a paradigm shift has occurred
The lesson has
whereby
been learned.
the lesson has been learned, right? So I have it still remains a risk, but my understanding and belief system is that the lesson has been learned. The United States government is very savvy, and they will ensure that this won't happen again. There will be a system in place that will allow companies and projects like Pilot Mountain to flourish well into the future. That's my belief.
Indeed. And the interesting thing, obviously, there's a strategic stockpile right next door to you that's been reopened, right? But I look at your potential production from the PFS. There are customers out there looking for tungsten, willing to pay a premium, who could take all of it, And I guess the question is, do you want to have like one potential defense sector prime saying we'll guarantee production for X number of years at this price? Or do you want to diversify your off-takers? And that's maybe a trickier question. I don't know. I don't know the answer, so I ask you.
Yeah, I mean, I'll kind of speak about it philosophically. I would say there is a benefit to diversification of offtakes. There's ways you can structure different offtakes to the benefit of the project and the company. I would say the way that we look at this, Charles, is ultimately, given the support we've already received from the United States government, from the Department of War, we want to ensure that as we build out this commercial program, we want to make sure that this project is really there to benefit the defense industrial base first, right? We want to give the opportunity to the major players who need this metal and need this take to have sort of not a right of first refusal, but certainly we want to have those conversations early, and we are having those conversations as we build out the commercial program. But ultimately we have to make decisions and sign off to provide the best long-term outlook for the project. But this is a very strategic asset. This is an asset that I think has a geopolitical sort of flair to it, and I think can really support US national security. Thereby, we have discussions across the board, and ultimately, we want to make sure that the way we build the commercial programs to the benefit of the United States first and the national security angle. And we can fill in around that because there's a significant amount of demand across defense, aerospace, cutting tools, oil and gas, you name it. So how we build that out, I think that gives you a bit of ideas that we look at that specific work stream, which is now very, very active for us.
I mean, the other thing, obviously, the key variable of any in any PFS is the pricing, right? And obviously the PFS uses a tungsten price around 35% below spot prices. Okay. Now, my belief is that spot prices are going to keep climbing because the only reason why is, unlike any other metal, there's no substitute for tungsten, whether it's for defense applications or nuclear fusion or whatever else you want to use it for. Now, obviously, it might it, you've built in that base case, But in your mind, just your personal opinion, and bear in mind, like CEOs of other tungsten projects around the world, I'm sure, where do you think the tungsten price goes in the next 5 years? Does it stay stable around here? Does it keep going up? Does it come down a little bit? What do you reckon is going to happen?
Yeah, it's a question I get asked, and I don't want to sit here and say where I think the price is going to land, but I'll tell you kind of how I look at the tungsten market.
You've had media training. Very good.
I have you almost caught me there, Charles, but I'm too smart for that. No, I mean,
Indeed.
I would say we're very bullish on the price, short and medium, and I'd say long term as well. I mean, I think where the price used to sit, I think we've recognized that that is not a natural price for tungsten, right? That was a price that was, I think, a reflection of heavy subsidization of Chinese mines. And we have now seen, and it's, I think it's, I'm reading articles over the last few weeks that says there's an official bifurcation here, right? There are now two prices. There's a Chinese price and there's a rest of the world price. Before there was really just one price. So I think we're going to now see proper market dynamics here when it comes to what that Western world price needs to ultimately be long term. On the supply side, I mean, the price of tungsten only started to move like a year ago. So a lot of companies who kind of picked up on that, I would say even early, are drilling for resources right now, right? There's a lot of companies in the United States who are drilling for resources, but to get to the PFS, this all takes time, right? So I think there's a lot of projects that are going to need kind of 5 to 10 years still
No,
before they
trust.
get into production.
Yeah, I mean, you started the trend, but there are the tungsten mines in the US
For
that,
sure. Yep.
but you know, some of them, I won't name them here, but will never get into production because they physically, the mentality is just not there. But
Correct.
others
I'd
are
agree with that.
viable,
Yep,
right?
for sure.
But they're 3, 4, 5 years down the line. They're too slow. And when do you need tungsten? When China's not selling any, you need it now.
Exactly.
You know,
Exactly.
and 20, yeah, go on. What are you going to
I
say?
was gonna say just quickly on the demand side, we're seeing, I would say, the defense demand. I mentioned this earlier, but I don't think we've really seen the defense demand start to take hold yet, right? So that's a whole new sort of demand angle that's not being, I think, appreciated yet because the US is getting their ducks in a row. They're trying to figure out who's going to build what. And as soon as they kind of get the order to go, okay, where's the tungsten going to come from, right? So I think that's a whole new demand angle. And how long is it going to take to restock and rearmor? Not only just in the US, but in the Western world and in NATO, you name it, right? So I think longer term, we're going to see a new paradigm here. We're going to see a proper Western world price, a Chinese price. And I think long term, that Western world price is going to be, I think, materially higher than what the previous norm was, which is obviously great for our project.
Look, it's the bottleneck, right? Rearmament alone, put aside nuclear fusion and other use cases,
Correct. Yeah.
there's not enough, right?
I don't
If
think there
there's
is. I
an
agree.
order for missiles, right, and like Lockheed needs to fulfill that order, if they don't have the physical metals to do it, they can't complete it, and that's
Correct.
the bottom line. Resource upside, though, I want to talk about this a little bit. So the
Sure.
current
Yeah, of
mine life
course.
is 8 years. Obviously, there's exploration going on. There's Tremor, Gunmetal, Good Hope. Obviously, there's Tampai Ute as well, which is a completely separate project, but it is
Yeah.
nearby. There's a couple of other operators exploring in the region. What do you think at the moment has got the greatest potential to add to mine life among your portfolio?
Okay, so we'll put Tampai Ute totally aside
Yeah,
because that's a
separate
whole
project.
different
No, that's
conversation.
fine.
Yeah, the long and short of Tampai Ute is, there's tremendous potential down dip, right? Just continually drilling further and further down dip. I think there's a lot to come there from Tampai Ute. But let's go back to Pound. I mean, Tremor off the hop really has us excited. We've been pretty clear about that. That was the first target we went after as soon as the PFS drilling was complete. So the first of, I would say, multiple targets on our list to see some of the intersections already. We put out the first hole. We've also flagged there's multiple holes that have hit very thick intersections of tungsten. So as it stands right now, Tremor is, it would be number one on my list. But like I said, that's just the first target we went after, right? We have Gunmetal. We have Good Hope. We've drilled Good Hope. Visually very interesting assays pending there. So I think very excited about Tremor, but at the end of the day, I think you're going to see ultimately a situation where multiple zones can be just sort of a hub and spoke model here. Now we need the drill bit to confirm that, but in a short period of time, we added Garnet in there, right? There's another booster for the project. We're drilling Tremor, assays pending for Good Hope, Gunmetal's permitted. There's other zones beyond that. So I think ultimately, if you fast forward a few years from now and what this can look like, I think ultimately, if we are successful, there's a real scenario where there's, hopefully 3, 4, 5+ zones across the project that are in some way, shape, or form included in a mine plan where we can go after all of them and blend them and bring them all to a central processing facility. That's our kind of goal and the way that we see this project playing out if, we continue to have success with the drill bit.
Yeah. And then final one from me, and then I'll have to hand back over to Kev. I mean,
Sure.
we could talk about this forever, but I'm aware your time is limited. A PFS stands for pre-feasibility study, but I'm reasonably sure it actually stands for pilot for sale in this context, obviously. But ultimately, those aren't conversations you can have until you have PFS numbers. You just can't, right? You can have them initially, but you need something to nail your mask to. You're talking about years and years away. I don't see a future personally where you're developing Pilot Mountain and Tenpai individually.
Sure.
It's either a larger company is going to come out and you become the minority partner as you go build it out, or you just straight up sell it. And I guess the question is, what do you see as the best outcome for shareholders? Is it a straight asset sale? Are you looking for a joint venture, or do you want to just go it alone? Because I think usually going it alone is a bad idea, but because the mineralization here is so simple and well known, it is a viable option, unlike in many other situations.
Yeah, and also I think what's changed, Charles, or what's different about this situation is the tailwinds, right? When you look at the administration that is currently in power in the United States and how they are supporting domestic projects, this is, I think, a situation we've never really fully experienced in our lifetime. And as someone who's been in this space for, 15 years now, not a huge amount of time, but call it 15 plus years, I've never worked in an environment supportive for projects like this. So that gives me a lot more confidence in the ability to go it alone. Now, what I'll say is, as a CEO, the way that we look at this is, my job is to represent shareholders, right? My job is to ensure, as a shareholder myself, my job is to find a path forward that is ultimately in the best interest of shareholders. That is why I'm in this seat. So we have put together a team of individuals who can, we believe, build these mines. There's no for sale sign up. This PFS, there's sort of two PFSs, and this is probably a bit cheeky to say, but there's two PFSs. There's a sort of a real let's go build it PFS, and then there's a promotional let's go sell this thing PFS. This PFS was the former. This is a let's go build this thing. And therefore, we view very little fluff in this. These are real numbers, and there's real quotes behind this. And, there's no, like I said, there's no fluff here, right? And that's, I think, probably signals to the market what we intend to do. That being said, we are commercial, right? We once again, we're here to represent shareholders. So, at the end of the day, we'll have any discussion that is warranted. But there's a part of us who, we really want to see this thing get built, right? We want to be able to cut the ribbon. We want to be able to hold the material. There's something I think, bigger that I think is driving us here, and how that really supports national security. I mean, that's this is not a gold mine. This is not just a whatever mine. This is a mine where the material can really support important industries, technology and AI and chips and
It's
fusion
look,
and solar, and
it's a
that's quite special, right? I think that's
okay,
how.
I'll stop you all there. Oliver, you can't answer this question until you understand how many hundreds of millions the US government are going to give you to basically help this process. You don't have to answer that, but for sure, the US government is coming with money. Otherwise, you cannot say that it's not. It's national interest, national security, and it's national everything. As I say, the red, white, and blue premium is there. The banner is above whatever asset you have that are tungsten. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to be happening over the coming months, because I don't think it's going to be a long period of time. I think you've openly said on other podcasts that, you know, you've applied for some of these grants all the way back in January. You know, the PFS solidifies those things, I presume. And yeah, we wish you nothing but luck. As Charles said, it's been a blast following you so far, from 7 or 8p all the way up to £3 and now back around £2. But I think the reality is that people are going to see the financial implications of this situation coming to fruition over the next few months. And you should benefit greatly, I think, because the valuation on the company now is really just for one part of it. Now that we look at the PFS Mountain, you have all those other different things, Pilot Mountain and also Tempayut, which I personally think could be bigger than Pilot Mountain in terms of the amount of tungsten it can produce. But you haven't got a PFS for that.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, that's all very good points. Yeah, no, it's a really exciting time for us, and we're super busy, so we will have a lot to talk about, I'm sure, over the next 6 to 12 months here.
Good. Oliver, one last question. Canada and US still in the World Cup. What are your predictions?
Well, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I'm probably more of an England fan than I am
good.
Any other
like
football side
that.
Right now.
That's
so,
good.
And I know they got to go to Mexico City here and try to beat Mexico on Sunday, which will be a tough one. But I mean, as a Canadian myself, I mean, it's been a pleasure to see Canada have success, and the United States looks very, very dangerous. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know if I really see any of those three teams winning this thing outright. But you know, you never know. Fingers crossed.
Yeah,
I'd be happy to see any of those teams win the whole thing. But
yeah.
France is looking pretty scary.
France looking good, yeah. Dominate.
Yeah, well, the England DRC game was a little bit scary for us. But I'll tell you, the only thing I can see happening, obviously, you know, if it's hosted in the United States, right, the Americans are going to look at football now and realize they're not the best in the world at it. So they're going to throw all the money and resources they possibly have. To bring on a proper, to create the best football team in the world, because that's what the Americans are.
I can see underestimate the United States of America. And I say that from a mining standpoint, people never underestimate them, because they have unlimited resources and can do so much when they put their mind to something, including help deliver tungsten mines in the United States. I'll bring it back to Guardian there.
Yeah.
Okay, on that note, we'll say Oliver Friesen, CEO of Guardian Metal Resources. Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it.
So our next guest is preparing to bring a very different story to the Aquis stock exchange. Revel Resources is aiming to unlock what is believed is Italy's forgotten uranium opportunity, with two historic projects in Lombardy that were extensively explored during the country's former nuclear program, and together host around £15 million of historically identified uranium. As Europe looks to strengthen energy security and nuclear power returns to the political agenda, the company believes the timing couldn't be better. Joining us is founder and executive director Ippolito Cattaneo to discuss why Italy, why uranium, why now, and how Revel plans to take advantage of what could become one of Europe's most intriguing uranium exploration stories. Welcome back, Ippo. Great to have you back on.
Good morning, Phil, Kev, Charles. Very nice to see you.
Absolutely. So just give us a breakdown, Ippo, as to why now, you know, why you believe that this spin out is timed perfectly.
Well, it's timed perfectly because a couple of weeks ago, Italy has, for the first time in its post-war history, definitively announced and inaugurated a period where nuclear energy is seemingly on its way back. So there are a series of reforms which basically lead to SMR, small modular reactors, being gradually adopted in Italy. So this is for a country that has always wrestled with its relationship with nuclear energy. You know, there's been various referendums in the 80s, 2000s. There's been at least two or three referendums on the subject. And Italy has consistently expressed, the Italian people have consistently expressed a negative stance towards nuclear energy for reasons that, in my view, are now no longer the case. And so what we have now is a situation where a country is finally embracing the nuclear pathway And the consensus is, and it's cross-party, which is very positive, that nuclear energy would, if there was a referendum today, the Italian people would vote favorably. Of course, there is something that I often refer to called the Australian paradox, because whether Italy embraces nuclear energy or it doesn't is entirely separate to what we're doing, which is engaging in exploration activities in Italy's largest uranium deposit, which is 2 hours from Milan in the north of Italy in the region of Lombardy. We currently have two applications, so we don't have the licenses yet. We have two applications for two exploration licenses for two separate projects, which, when put together, represent Italy's largest uranium deposit. So it's an exciting opportunity. These are two underground, you can call them mines, but they never went into production. So that again is the opportunity. Fully built underground infrastructure. We've got about almost 20 kilometers of underground workings. We've got 90, almost 90,000 meters of drilling. And so the goal will be to get the environmentals for both licenses. We've submitted one EIA application already, where on or before the 15th of July, we will submit the second one, get the EIAs approved, get the licenses on the back of those approvals, and then engage in resource definition, because we want to redrill the historical deposit, delineate the resource in accordance with JORC to the market, and show what the size of the resource, which, as you mentioned, there's it's a very substantial, more than $1 billion historical resource in the ground. So this is a project which has 200 to 300 million euros equivalent investment just by virtue of the drilling, the infrastructural investments, and we're extremely calm now with this positive backdrop and with all the geopolitical turmoil that has engulfed world and Europe specifically in terms of energy supply. Energy autonomy is a very thematic subject in this modern day. So we think the timing, to go back to your original point in your question, the timing cannot be better.
Yeah, just playing devil's advocate. I mean, Italy moved away from nuclear power sort of decades ago. So, what gives you the confidence that now is the right time to revive uranium exploration? And I guess, what are the key catalysts that investors should be watching for over the next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, so this goes back to the first point. The reality is that whether Italy embraces nuclear energy or not is entirely separate to our uranium applications and the success or non-success of our applications, because there's no uranium exploration. It's simply the case that in the public perception, uranium and nuclear energy are, inextricably, they're intrinsically linked, right? So there's no conflated all the time. But the reality on a sort of legal and in paper terms, whether Italy embraces nuclear energy and whether we get our permits are two entirely separate matters. Of course, the backdrop is very favorable. In fact, many people say to me, you could not have chosen a better moment to put these applications in. We've done a lot of very good work with the communities, because the success of these two projects is entirely dependent on local support. So we have done, even before we applied for these licenses, the very first thing we did was approach the local towns for each project, speak to the respective municipal authorities, and understand what their expectations were and what their feelings were towards a potential, reopening, although it's not really a reopening now, because we will be engaged in exploration activities, so there's not going to be any production activities in the near term. So, we've done, our main focus now is getting the EIAs approved. We believe that upon getting the permits, this could be one of Europe's most exciting uranium stories, right? If you look at the peer review table, people always bring up the energy in Spain. Of course, they've had a very difficult journey. Their resource, from what I can read, is, compared to the historical resource we have, is a lower grade resource. It's larger in size, but we think that with the exploration activities we will be to undertake upon EIA approval, that we can substantially increase the resource size.
Absolutely. And just talk us through I believe you said you've raised 2 million at IPO. So just talk us through that whole process and what the funds are going to be used for.
Yeah, so well, the IPO has been very well oversubscribed, so it's been a lot of good participation. Myself as CEO of Ajax, so I've invested in a personal capacity as Ippolito. Ajax has invested in the pre-IPO, and Zenith Energy, which is where this project was incubated, is the largest shareholder in the company. And then Andrea, the CEO of Zenith Energy, has also taken a position which is equal to my own. So we've got four founders, if you will, underpin the listing. We then have Yorkville that have now come back to the UK and exceptionally well in the US and have taken a keen interest in natural resources. That is something that we're very, very happy with, that they participated. They will have a significant stake in the business. And then we have our director, who's put a good chunk of money in himself, which again underlines the board participation and commitment to the company. And then we've got, you know, a series of other investors who I know of from Europe, specifically Italy, and then some good UK investors that we've attracted as well. So we think the book is very compact. It's been, you know, people have complimented us saying you've done quite well. We've done the money when combined with the pre-IPO money. We raised about 680,000 in the pre-IPO, so a total raise of about 2.6 million. That money will be used to advance the EIA patients that we have, working capital. And then in conjunction with the fundraise, we also issued a new instrument called the 10p loyalty warrants. So the issue price is 5p, the warrants are priced at 10p. And the condition, or one of the vesting conditions for the warrants, is that the investors must prove to the company that they continue to hold the original IPO shares that they subscribed for in order for those IPO warrants to be exercisable, right? So there's a big focus on loyalty. So, you know, what we want to do is to get those warrants in the money, and ensure that dilution is minimized, right? So the next fundraise, as when it will not be in the near term, because we've got, you know, quite a few months now of getting the EIAs approved. When that happens, it will be at a very significantly higher price to the IPO price, so the dilution can be minimized. So the beauty of this stock, and I think the key ingredient to its success, will be the fact that the shareholder register is so compact.
Okay, Ippolito, I'll ask you a question. I'm going to go back to your days at Zenith. You were the one who found this asset in the first place, isn't that right?
Yeah, so I found this one. I found it as Ajax. So I kind of discovered these opportunities with my Ajax hat on, and then it occurred to me that because they were in Italy and Ajax had no history of operating in Italy, and technical and financial competence is a key criteria for a successful applicant, that at that point I decided to partner with Zenith that had a history of financial and technical competence in Italy, which was recognized by the ministry. And so that's why we incubated it through. I mean, Ajax, as you know, is a natural resources company. Zenith is an oil and gas arbitration place. So that's why the Zenith wouldn't typically pursue this opportunity, but that's why we went through Zenith.
Very good. So what attracted to you, it's like when you meet your girlfriend or your wife, what first attracted you to this asset?
So what I liked is, again, very, very much in full compliance with the Ajax strategy. We solely or almost solely focus on assets with significant historical investment, which for whatever reason have not had that value maximization. And there's a lot of potential which just simply hasn't been realized. And so that is the beauty of this project, is that we have such a significant amount, such a singular amount of historical investment. You know, Eni, the national oil company, by way of its subsidiary at the time, in the, you know, 60s and 70s and early 80s, define this resource. If you visit the project on our website, on the Rivali website, there'll be a very nice, on the homepage, there'll be a drone video of covering one of the bigger of the two projects, Valvadello. And you really get a sense of the scale of how much money and how much you know, technical investment has gone into the project. So I thought, you know, I found this opportunity just by complete chance. I was speaking to a geologist and I was always very much attracted to Italy's mining history, because Italy is a country which few people talk about. This basically has a very rich mineral endowment and a lot of historical mineral activity, mining activity. So the question I asked was, well, you know, why is a nation which has such a significant mineral endowment, which has a long mining history, why are there no mines operating today, and are there any mines that we can pursue? And this geologist responded saying, well, it's not for everyone, because, you know, uranium, especially in Italy, is a sensitive topic. And he said, it's not for everyone, but there is an opportunity that comes to mind, which is, you know, how do you feel about two fully built or two significant, you know, underground projects in northern Italy, which cumulatively Italy's largest uranium resource? And so immediately when I heard this, I said, well, say no more, let's go. And so we went, we did quite a lot of work. We engaged with the local municipal authorities, and then we advanced the applications. This was back in 2024. So a lot of work has gone in to these applications to get them to where they are today. And we then submitted the applications to the region. And we were the first applicant in the history of these projects to get to where we are now, because there was a previous applicant in 2006 who didn't. So we learned from that lesson what one of the key mistakes that applicant made, and they weren't from Italy, they were from Australia, was that they did not engage. There was a series of mistakes, but one of the key mistakes they made was they did not engage the local communities, the local towns. They just sent the application in the post and the towns were not involved. And so, of course, that completely alienated them. And Italy was also historically a very different period in its perceptions, very different. 2006, which was, you know, 20 years ago, sentiment was very different. We now see with this current government, and also just with world events, regardless of the government in place, you know, it's not a political point. There's cross-party support on the subject. You know, nuclear energy is on its way back. And all the fears and all scaremongering of nuclear energy being dismantled, I would say, because Switzerland and France have power, nuclear power stations just across the border. So, you know, if you fear a nuclear apocalypse, which is one of the key fears surrounding nuclear energy, you know, that fear is not going to stop at the border, right? It's going to cross the border and it's going to... So Italy, whether Italy likes it or not, it already is exposed to nuclear energy. And so that's a very simple point, but a strong one, which really underscores that nuclear energy is there whether you like it or not. So I think there's a lot of reasons to like it more than dislike it.
Okay, Charles, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting because when you're looking at the companies that have done really well for us over the past few years, there two things kind of jump out. The first is capital structure, right? So what's the effective free float once you take out what's not going to get traded? You know, 25% of the shares an issue. If you're saying, you know, what, that's like 15, 20 million shares that's available, that's not very much to go around. A lot of those are being held very tightly. So that's going to make life a lot easier. But the other thing is infrastructure, right? Like, so one of my, you know, best plays has been Amaroq. They went into Nalunaq, obviously millions and millions of dollars of infrastructure already there when they got started. So you're kind of like a hybrid of both, is what it feels like to me. Because you're sitting on, what, 250, 300 million euros of underground infrastructure that AGIP built, and you don't have to pay for. So doesn't that massively de-risk the capital intensity of the project versus a greenfield?
Yeah, and I think the beauty of it is we know the resources there, right? So we're, you know, the horror, the shock horror of junior exploration companies is you know, you do all this drilling, you spend all this money, and then you don't have the resource. We have the resource. We historically, that we know there is a resource there. We have little data on it because much of it was lost, but we are working with some geologists, one geologist specifically, who was the very senior, or was the head geologist of one of the two projects. So we know the resource is there, and we simply need to re-drill it and prove it and possibly, and we, you know, we're confident, increase it, you know, increase the size of it. So in the underground workings, I've walked down both of the two projects, and they're in spectacularly good condition. So despite, you know, 40 years of being closed. So that historical investment is key. And that's, again, it's in line with the Ajax strategy of investing in projects which have varying degrees of very significant historical investment. So in this case, we've got hundreds of millions of projects that Ajax has pursued. We've got, you know, in the tens. So, but more or less that the underlying strategy is always the same.
Yeah. And this is the thing, right? That historical 50 million investment, right? Assuming it holds up under modern JORC or PERC verification, and it could even grow once you get into those unsafe stockpiles. But where does it put Valvadello and Novazzo relative to other European uranium assets in terms of scale?
So, well, I should say, just for regulatory reasons, that resource is historical. It's not compliance.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Which
assuming
I know
it stands up.
So our goal is to increase that resource to beyond number, that historical number, which again we is not JORC compliant. But where it stacks up is it's smaller than at this stage than the Berkeley Energy resource, from what I've read. It's higher grade than the Berkeley Energy resource. I'm using Berkeley Energy as one of the, well, as a key comparable in Europe. I don't think there's many more. The idea is to increase the resource beyond that number, that historical number, and then, you know, and then go back to the market with that MRE, which, you know, Berkeley Energy, it's got a, I think, 100, 120 million market cap. And of course, the arbitration they've got and all the problems they've had into that. So if it wasn't, I presume, I would expect the valuation to be significantly higher than what it is today. So yeah, so what in substance, what this will be is one of the most exciting European uranium opportunities that we have, especially in a listed company, right? So that's the goal. If you think about the 4 million market cap, and where this can go, then there you have your answer. You've got all the historical investment, the underground workings, which need to be factored in. because it's not just a question of just having the resource, it's also a question of having that infrastructure. So I mean, I don't want to make any predictions in terms of numbers because that's not my place, and it can lead to
slap
to mistakes,
wrist, maybe. Yeah.
Exactly. But I think, you know, the fundamentals are right. So, you know, people, a lot of people during the IPO have said to me, well, you've priced this quite low. It's very competitive, you know, 4 million market cap. Of course, we don't have the licenses yet. That's a key point to underline. We are very confident we will get them. We have no reason to doubt that we will get them. We don't have them there now. So there is an element of risk, which is involved in any investment in the small cap sector. But we're confident that because the timing is right, because we've done our work well, and we've put a tremendous amount of work into these applications, we're confident we'll get those applications across the line. And then as soon as we've got them, we'll start drilling and defining the resource.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that I find quite interesting is London has almost no pure play uranium exposure. There's resources doing, you know, exploration out in Namibia. Power Metals has a joint venture out doing a little bit in the Athabasca. But that's pretty much it, right? So the other question is, how much of the investment case is simply first mover into this gap of uranium demand where investors are just going to want exposure and they can't get it anywhere else?
Well, that's a good point. The other thing that we specifically did is, we, you know, we have other European opportunities that we like. So, but they were not, well, not all of them, some of them are, not all of them uranium opportunities. So what we've done with Revali is we've made it specifically a solely uranium play. And that's something that we very much wanted to make sure was the case, because we've noticed that uranium investors are very metal centric. They don't want stories that are looted by, you know, having other metals in there. So Revali will pursue uranium opportunities in Europe. And we already have a few other opportunities in mind, because the question we often get is, well, you know, what happens if you don't get the applications, if they're not successful? There is a theoretical risk that may happen. We don't think it will happen, but it may happen. If that does happen, we have other opportunities that we can put in to Revali. But we think these two opportunities will underpin the company and will enable us to do, you know, I often say this ad nauseam, but, you know, we see Delta Gold. It's, well, what we didn't mention at all during this interview so far, during this conversation, is the Aquis side to it. You know, this is an Aquis listed business. We will be listing on Aquis, and this has proven to be a fantastic arena for value creation. Delta Gold being the most recent and spectacular exact. So we think our capital structure and the opportunities, the fundamentals, support a trajectory. Maybe I'm being too ambitious, but, you know, Delta Gold's been so successful that we should be a bit more humble and not say that we'll replicate it. But, you know, that's the blueprint.
Well, I'll replicate it. And there's, you know, as a first base, if the IPO price is 5p and the warrant is 10, you know, if you're at that 10p price and everyone gets to exercise their warrants, you know, that would be a good start and make life a lot easier, you know, going forward. But I think the key thing, right, is Italy reversed 40 years of anti-nuclear policy in a single parliamentary vote, right? Obviously, that's very rare. But now the political winds are turning. And I think it's not just a parliamentary vote. It's the, they got rid of, basically got rid of nuclear and said, right, we'll just rely on gas from Russia. And then that's probably not been the best idea. But we'll rely on gas from, you know, going through the Strait of Hormuz, also not a good idea. That energy security independence, if you look at, you know, Lombardy, where you're based, businesses, you know, because I used to live in Italy, they are really struggling with energy prices, like in the UK. So it's not, you know, when you talk about like political tailwinds, it like on the coal face, in real life, these companies, they want baseload power, and nuclear is the way forward. It just is. I mean, would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. I think energy pricing in Italy has been very, you know, it's a big, and when you're talking about the cost of living crisis, which is very topical in across Europe and in the UK, but also in Italy, energy pricing, you know, families that have to pay increasingly energy bills, you know, that is a theme. But then we should also talk about the energy security aspect, right, which has been the most topical point this year and the last year. You know, the fact that we mentioned this earlier in our conversation, you know, we Europe as a whole is now militarizing. You know, we see Germany, which is debating whether to introduce conscription again, to reintroduce conscription. Defense spending is on its way up across all European countries. And so we've got a drive towards militarization, which, you know, is good in the sense that it's towards defending the nation. So that defending the European Union from any enemies that are perceived to be there. And then we also have, in line with that, we've got energy security, right? Because we've got fears surrounding energy autonomy, energy supply, energy pricing. So all these themes come together and mean that we have a drive towards exploring energy sources that were previously neglected, rightly or wrongly. I don't want to take a position on the uranium debate. That's not for me to do. I'm just the executive director of an exploration company. But we find ourselves, we can only take note of these factors and sense the opportunity, right? So we feel that there is a significant opportunity. We've named our subsidiary in Italy Futuro Energetico Italiano, which translates as future, the Italian energy future, which is not a coincidental name choice, right? We think uranium and nuclear energy is the future.
Yeah, and you don't need to speak Italian, as we both do, to translate that one. But last question from me, and then we'll leave you. So the IPO date has been pushed back a couple of times. And, this does happen. You're not the first company it's happened to. And given the IPO pipeline coming, you almost certainly won't be the last. But what's the reasoning behind it? Is it just some of the delays?
There is no reasoning per se. Of course, when you've got delays, people fundraise hasn't been subscribed for, or there's been some kind of disaster. There hasn't been a disaster. The fundraise is concluded. We were very happy, as we mentioned, we've raised the 2 million number, oversubscribed fundraise. So there's no issue on that front. We've had a minor, we've had someone who's forgot to send a form in on time. So one of the advisors has let us down. And so we're now, we've had a delay for that reason. So we're now getting that resolved. And we're listing, we believe and hope, and finally getting this done on Tuesday morning. So it's been a disappointing experience on that front. These things happen. Human error is a theme. We're talking
a few days, aren't we? And this is a multi-year story.
It doesn't change anything in the wider scope thing. I mean, in a world of AI, human error is going to be increasingly less of a phenomenon. But we still have human error this day and age, and so that's why we were delayed. But look, it's all resolved. There's nothing behind these delays that is of any consequence. If anything, we're teasing the market. So when we open on Tuesday morning, people will be wrestling, a bit like those Black Friday sales when people are running through the doors to get the those deals. Hopefully we'll have a similar thing.
It's a much better day. It's my issue of my engagement, 7-7. So you're going to be 7-7-2026. I think it's going to be a good day. And I think there's a lot of people who want to take a position in uranium plays. This is going to be literally the only one in London, I think, that is completely exclusively uranium. Yeah, we wish you the best of luck, and we look forward to progress of what's happening. Obviously, over the first few months, we need to people need to understand the project. As you said, there are some information out there, some videos already for the project, which is pretty spectacular to look at. I think Charles is going to write an article in the next couple of weeks, which will come out, and people will have a greater overview of it. And then we'll discuss with you again, and maybe we get some uranium experts that you've got on your staff to come and talk about, why this project is what it is, because I think that is important. I mean, ultimately, this project could be worth hundreds of millions, if not billions, if it comes to fruition.
Well, that's what we're working towards. So we believe in it. We put a lot of our own money into it, as we always do with our companies. And so we think the timing's right and the opportunities are the right ones. And so we're, there's a commitment from the board to give their utmost to bring this to fruition. So that, Tuesday morning will be the start of that journey.
Very good. Hey, Palito, good luck.
Thank you, Kev. Thank you, Charles. Very nice talking to you.
Well, we welcome our very special guest here now is Jonathan Swan. I was going to say experienced investor, but that would be untrue. So, Jonathan, I understand that while you were in the United States of America last week, you had a bit of a road trip.
Yeah, well, I was in Vegas on a girls' trip, actually. I was the only bloke on it to see Kenny Chesney at the Sphere, which is an absolutely superb venue if you ever want to go to a concert. Never been anywhere like it. And I thought, I can't hang around with these girls all the time, so I need to go on a trip. So I asked Oliver if I'd go and visit one of his mines, and he kindly agreed. And so I went to see Tempayu, which is about 150 miles north of Vegas.
Okay, so tell us what your impressions are. Tell us, did you manage to get any juicy information from people on the ground there? And just what your thoughts?
Yeah, so I met George, who seems to be one of the managers there. He lives in the village called Rachel. Now, Rachel's got like 40 people in this village, and it's probably 5 miles from the mine, and then it's 10 miles from Area 51, which is where all the American secret stuff hangs out. So in that village, there's one little gas station, one little pub called Little Ale Inn, which is an alien. I think they're one of them, Little Alien. So it's 40 miles to Ash Springs, which is the nearest town south, 120 miles north to Tenapah. So it's in the absolute middle of nowhere, this place. So I did a little bit of research before I went there, so I thought I'd better know a little bit about it. So Tempayu history, it was discovered in 1965, silver, zinc, copper, and they began developing tungsten in 1916. And it became intermittently one of the largest producers in the USA, depending on whether the tungsten price was high. And then a few times the Chinese wiped the price down and they closed up. So they were a huge producer, 1940 to 50 with Lincoln Mines. And then you've got Hua Chang, which is Black Rock Mining, 50 to 57. And then it closed when the Chinese flooded the market with tungsten and the price dropped 75%. And then you've got Union Carbide in 1977 to 87. So they built this town of Rachel, and they had about 700 miners back then. And one day they were all queuing up for work, and they were just told mine shut, and they're closed. So it's interesting when you look at this mine, it's because I haven't seen many mines, but for me it looks absolutely huge. It's got two and a half kilometers of length. New areas are now being targeted. It's got vertical shafts of 350 meters, 60,000 meters of tunnels. So the area is huge. And then when they were left, there was lots of stockpiles of ore just sitting there waiting to be processed, because they all just got kicked off. So I think overall it's much bigger than I thought it would be. I went there on a Saturday, and they worked 7 days a week. So they're really on the case to get this thing processed. Near the top of the mountain, there was one drill in action. There were four people working on that. There's another drill that just arrived that was getting ready to be put into action. And then I met three geologist-type dudes. One of them was investigating the current drill holes. The tungsten had been discovered on the drill hole they're currently drilling, the big one. And then two of them were doing they've got about 120 small little drill holes they're doing in the tailings. So they're about 120. So they're really working on the tailings. So the tailings go for about 3.5 kilometers length to 1.25 kilometers across. So I think they're much, much bigger than anticipated. And I basically think it's a low hanging fruit. So overall, I think the deposit is 0.4% WO3, so it's tungsten trioxide, and it hosts scheelite tungsten. And apparently there's two types of this stuff, and this is the good one. I don't know what the other one is, but apparently they tell me this is the one you want if you're going mining. So driving up the mountain, there's these stockpiles of ore that were waiting to be processed when they shut it down. And the mountain roads are sort of built on this ore rather than just normal rocks. So when you have these mountain roads, you put sort of piles of it alongside so you don't fall off the cliff. So they were using this ore to help build the road. So they weren't short of it. So there's a lot of it hanging around up there. But overall, though, I thought the tailings was the most salient point due to the urgent requirement for the USA tungsten production. In the old days, they could only recover something like 60% compared to what they can recover today. So basically 40% of everything mined is sitting in these tailings, which is a huge amount when you come to think about it, considering it's been off and on the biggest mine in America. The dam the tailings must have been in some sort of dam, and that must have burst sometime. So that's why it's flooded down the valley. So these things go from 3.5 kilometers down the valley. And the ease of getting this stuff is amazing, because you just rub your feet on the ground. All this sort of orange dust is just available there. So it's almost like you could send your children. It's like getting sand off the beach. This stuff is just sitting there waiting to be processed.
And so how excited were the staff on the ground about the tailings and about?
They don't say a lot, but they seem very excited about the tailings. I think this is enormous. And when you're looking at the government grant coming in, it wouldn't surprise me if the grant isn't to speed up the processing of the tailings, because that's low hanging fruit and it's going to be massive. If 2/3 of whatever's come out, you've got 2/3 of what they've sold sitting there in the mine right now, in the tailings. So it's absolutely enormous, I think. So they seem very excited about the tailings more than anything else, because the there are already mine stuff sitting there that could be a few months, could be years worth. I don't know. But the tailings is everything the mine's ever dug up.
Well, it's 550 acres or so. It's massive. But did you get to see any of the scheelite or the minerals under the black light? Because that's always a fun thing.
Yeah, so you see what they've been digging out, and they come in the tubes, don't they? So they crack it open and you look at all the tubes. So the mine is the new bits they're mining has got it in there. Well, I don't know the quantity and all that. You can see it all shining away. I've got some pictures of it shining away.
Yeah. Did you get to go underground at all? Did they keep you above the ground? No.
Well, I got told off because I went with my flip flops and shorts because I was on holiday. There's some very, very strict rules for the mining. Yeah. And so when I went near the drill, I got told off by the chief driller up there, you can't come down here or up there with flip flops on. But we didn't go down. I'm not sure how much underneath they're doing.
There's 200,000 feet of underground workings, right? Like it's 7 levels historically. It's just the size of it. It's just crazy. But I imagine when you're kind of obviously it's a mountain when you're standing on there. Visually, what does it look like? What can you see as you're kind of looking out over the valleys? Is it just nothing? There's nothing there.
You've got the one little village.
Yeah,
one little village. You can't see the Area 51, but there's that village. It's like 50 miles to the next place. It's all straight roads going through massive valleys of desert, effectively.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember that my wife and I, when we were both 21. This is obviously quite a few years ago, and before we were married, we did a big road trip of the States. And obviously, if you just go to Vegas, it's just like you don't really appreciate it. But it is in the middle of the desert, and this is miles and miles and miles of nothing. And it's kind of underappreciated, right? If you want to blow up some rocks at Tempayu, there's going to be no problems, right? Because there's just nobody there.
No, in that village, there's 40 people, and there must be all they do is either work in the mine, I guess, or they're working in the one pub or the gas station. There's just absolutely nothing to do.
I mean, the interesting question is, right, obviously, if you actually bring it back up to, proper production, presumably you're going to need hundreds of people, right? And we're not talking just infrastructure, like the mill building or the substation. That village is going to have to get bigger, literally just for personnel, right?
It was 700 originally when Union Carbide had it. And then it's just, it looks really, that most of them seem to be shacks rather than houses and stuff. It's very run down.
Did you ask the team there? I'm trying to think of the words. Did you ask the team there? You know what they were doing, what the assays were looking like, what they were digging out of the ground. Did you get told off trying to do that?
I get the impression they're very, very happy with what they're getting, and I think the tailings bit's going to be faster than Q1 next year. They seem to be really on it. These holes aren't that big, so they can get through them quite a lot. And I think they're finding a lot more than they thought they were going to be finding. And you can look at the stats on Nevada Bureau of Mining produces stats on how much each mine produces and all that sort of stuff. And I found some reports up to 1958, which is basically before the Union Carbide bit came in. And they sold tungsten in 56, which was the biggest year I could find, $3.8 million worth. And that was a 60% sort of recovery compared to 100 today. So that equals about $6 million of tungsten sales back in 1956. Now, what's that worth today as a yearly production? Now, inflation makes it 11 times alone, and then the tungsten price has rocketed recently. I don't know. I've got an estimate of 150 million production a year, but it could be much higher. I really don't know what the price of tungsten has done since then. Yeah, so the numbers here are quite big. I think there's an awful lot still to be dug. So they seem to have big areas of this stuff that was never got to, and they're finding the similar levels of WO3, as they call it, in there.
Did the guys give you an idea of
how many years of stuff is in the tailings or not really?
No, but if you work out, if the tailings have got 2/3 of everything that's ever been sold, and it's been the biggest tungsten mine over the years in America, that's a lot of. I think they're going to announce some huge numbers, is my guess on this. And the stock part is all sitting there waiting to be just, all you have the processing plant, it'll be ready to go. There seems to be a lot of chatter about future government grants coming in for Pilot Mountain and this one, but the easiest and most quickest would be processing this stockpile that's just sitting there.
Yeah, well, the thing is, they've been blown up already. They've been processed already once. And if you can get 40% of the tungsten that they couldn't get out before, out of it now.
Well, basically, that's 2/3 of what they've got out. They've taken out 60, 40's left. It's actually enormous, isn't it?
Yeah, well, indeed. It'll be quite fun to see then. Because the key thing, the thing that Oliver's always told me, right, and this is no secret, but what the US cares about most is getting tungsten production as quickly as possible, right? And it seems to me that Tempayu can be quicker than Pilot Mountain, simply because
it's got to be much quicker because you've got all this stuff ready to be processed. And also, in the place, you've got loading facilities, the mill, the concentrate processing building, you've got water that's 5 miles of pipes. It's basically all the infrastructure is there to get going. Plus, you've got all the stockpile of what waiting to be processed. Is there a processing plant there? You can send your children to pick it up. It's just lying there. So diggers, lorry, I don't know. Maybe you can even dig it out. Are there any tungsten processing plants in America anyway?
A lot of it needs to get built. Is the short answer. There are a couple that they're pretty far away. But, the US government announced a strategic stockpile for the stuff pretty much right next door to Tempayu. So it doesn't take a genius to work out what the plan is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, while you were in Vegas as well, I mean, I know, that the ladies were there for a show. Any gambling done? Or is that not your style?
I don't really bother with the gambling too much. I don't like those electronic machines because I think they always cheat and they just don't pay out.
Well, they're not fun. I don't know. No. But the blackjack tables can be quite entertaining. For a time.
Yeah, they seem to be. There seems to be a lot of action on those things. I've never played that too much, so I don't. My colleague, World Poker Championship. He goes in properly for that.
Oh, fair enough. I mean, I wouldn't have imagined you'd take any interest in anything that was high risk or risking.
I should just buy some more GMAC shares. Looking at this, the GMAC price is nicely down, and they get this huge stockpile that hasn't been announced yet.
Oh, it's going to be super fun when they do. Yeah.
So, Jonathan, did you manage to go to this small pub that was next to Tempayu? It would be.
I did go to the small pub. I had an alien burger in there with chips. And it's quite funny. There's an English bloke that seems to be managing it, and he said, "I came here 7 years ago, and I haven't left." I'm going, "Bloody hell! You go sit in this little place, and you love it so much." But I think he might be. He says, "Sometimes at night we see these things flying around, and they probably are aliens, or the American government have got some secret stuff that is absolutely out on the limb." Because he says, some of this stuff, it really winds them up if it's early in the morning and late at night. But there's things flying around there that he thinks is really odd, and it's not normal stuff. So there probably is some really cool stuff being developed down there. But it seems strange that he went there and stayed and hasn't left, because there's not a lot to do there.
Maybe he's an alien himself, and he's just telling you that.
Well, maybe
he came from Liverpool, didn't he?
You're secretly outing an MI6 agent has been spying.
Jonathan, this is your first time on the Sunday roast. So, what is the roast? The roast dinner in the Swan household.
What is the roast? I always go for lamb, but the Americans don't like lamb too much. But I prefer lamb.
And lashings of gravy or not?
Not really. Mint sauce. Bit of gravy.
Very good. Okay, and the last question. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I always think the best piece of advice for business is in their own business. Always look forward on the business. You don't sit there, because you sit there and wait for deals to come in. So sometimes you stop capital expenditure to get the profit up, EBITDA up. You should go full steam ahead. Don't worry about artificially trying to get the prices right for your sale and all that sort of stuff. Just look forward completely and utterly, and never look back. Build the business of the future. Don't worry about intermittent spikes, downgrades. Because the better you build the business, the higher the PE ratio will be at the end of the day. So you don't need to worry about artificially having a high number here and there when you need to do your five-year PE deals and that sort of stuff. So build the business. Don't worry about, just build it for the future. Make it the best business you possibly can. And a chap called Dave Walker told me that.
And what's the best advice you've ever given?
Oh, crikey. Best advice I've ever given?
Yeah. Don't tell someone to not have another drink at any point?
Don't follow my share tips as much as that.
Take out insurance, maybe.
Insurance is an odd thing. It sounds very, very boring, but if you're not in sort of individual retail stuff and you're doing companies, it's a brilliant business. Mm. And every year, most things renew, so it's a renewable business, and then it just gradually grows and grows.
Well, if you look at the FTSE 100, right? What are the best dividend stocks that the UK has? They're all insurers, right? It's Legal & General, it's Aviva, it's Phoenix. And then all the way down, you know, to any insurance company that's run properly, it's kind of one of the few companies that, you know, the few sectors where if you run it properly and you get lucky when you start out, it's you're onto a winner, right? It must be.
You've got the cat exposures for like hurricanes, or technically there could be a cyber exposure when everyone gets taken out by the same attack. So there are some catastrophes out there, but as long as you've got reinsurance to smooth it all out. But it's just the thing, everyone, every year people come back and buy again. There's not many businesses where everyone comes and buys products every single year. And and when the claims come in, premiums go up. So you sort of, there are people that make losses in insurance because there are some crappy insurance companies out there. But generally, as a book, it's a very good business to be in. And if you're doing the corporate stuff, it's also quite fun because you're going around meeting clients and things. So there's a lot of lunches involved. It's bad for your health, I'd guess.
But... Yeah, indeed. I think what put me off it years ago was the concept of circular insurance. We're probably going off topic now, but every kind of insurance that, you know, you've taken out, the insurance company has itself taken out insurance on the insurance it's provided, growing up like an endless chain forever and ever and ever. It means that, you know, it almost means that, you know, unless there's a catastrophic global event, nothing can really fail because it's so interconnected. But I don't know. I don't know.
I think the amount of money that gets paid out in claims to the claimants, when you take out all the lawyers and everything else and all the profits, is a very small percentage. It wouldn't surprise me if it's less than 30% actually gets paid to claims compared to the premiums.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. But
so it's a very inefficient business in theory. That in theory should have got thought computer systems and stuff would improve that. But I think it's still probably quite inefficient, really, in reality. But
So anyway, from your trip, you were happy with your investment in Guardian Metal.
Yeah, very happy. I've never really worried about the price going up and down because I bought in early. So my average was 11p because it was 8p or 9p, whatever it was. Then I bought more when they did the 60p raise and it dropped to 50 something. So I bought a few more. So my average went up to 11. And I'm sitting on it until I know Charles thinks it will sell one day. And I think it probably will because someone will buy it. And then because they're splitting out they're having tungsten alone, it sounds like they're getting the tungsten ready to sell and to keep the rest a separate company. But I'm just going to sit there and until it sells, and I don't really worry about day-to-day price movements. And I don't bother taking my stake out, which I know you say take your stake out and all that sort of stuff. But
well, I tell you, I almost sold everything at a pound. And then I thought, do you know what? I made the right call. You can't cash out before the end game, can you? And then it went to 3. And now it's at 2, and I've kind of switched off from it. You know, what will be, and it will pay out when it pays out. And whether that's 6 months, a year. Yeah, 100%. So possibly you can wait a little bit longer than I can. So we shall see.
You can wait. You don't need a new swimming pool just yet.
No. A few more years at least. But I suspect 12 more months and it's gone would be my best guess, but we will see.
Yeah, and my best guess is that I think we're going to be several 100% higher than we are now. As a buyout, that would be my guess. But
I think these tailings, I think they're working very hard to get them analysed and work out exactly what they've got. So it wouldn't surprise me to see the next big thing will be government grant for the tailings process. That'd be a big number attached to it, which would be multiples of the current value of the company. Will be my sort of.
Yeah.
I could be completely wrong. I don't know. It's just. Well, my gut feel says that there's an enormous amount of mining that's been going on here. So there's a massive amount of tailings sitting there over the years. Because I've got no idea how much Union Carbide took out, but 700 miners working for 10 years, that must be a fair chunk.
It's very similar in a way for the all the copper tailings that are in Zambia that they've got, Jubilee have got. I forget the name of it now because I visited it. But it's like just goes on for kilometers of just huge piles of stuff, which if it gets processed properly is going to be worth billions of dollars, billions. So, yeah, it's good that you've seen it. Thank you for coming on the roast. And
thank you very much for having me on the roast.
You're welcome, sir.
Kev, in terms of movers and shakers, not a massive amount happened this week, but I want to pull out a couple of sort of standout RNSs. I think Tuesday we saw Kendrick release the Teufelskuppe new drill results for TKD D001 to 003. There was unalized core was obviously returned outstanding individual PXRF values of 6.4% WT percent, 3.9% WT, 3.8 and 2.5 total rare earth oxides within the upper section of the hole, further enhancing the mineralized profile. And then previously reported exceptional intercepts from the 001 remain unchanged, including the 8.14% TREOs over 21 meters. So what did you make of that? And what do you think it demonstrates in terms of the actual project now?
It's just demonstrating more results that are similar to what was coming. So that obviously is a positive in terms of the overall project. You know, this is going to, I just don't think anybody grasps the size of this. I think, you know, the actual size of the thing, I think, is going to be district scale for the two projects, if you like. And I think when people do grasp it, they're going to realize how, you know, undervalued it currently is. But there are two things that I think we're waiting for. The first thing is the metallurgical results. So in other words, how easy is this stuff going to be processed? Is there any uranium in it? Is there any other bad stuff in it, basically? Now, if that comes out as a thumbs up, it can be processed well and all is good, then people have got to realize that they've got literally billions of dollars worth of rare earths that can be processed. And then the second thing, which I think we will get within the next, I think the first thing we're going to get within the next few weeks, the second thing is going to be basically the quantum and the initial quantum, and that initial quantum should be, you know, pretty sizable, even based on what they talked about, 14 million tons, I think it was, of the stuff that is on the surface. So, yeah, I think ultimately patience is going to pay out, but people need to get a realization of its current value.
Sure.
I mean, I think what Charles wrote was $400 million net present value. You know, it's less than 30 million pounds at the minute.
Yeah.
And so we've got a huge gap.
Yeah. The other standout one was Energy Pathways. They announced the award of the gas storage license for the MESH project, and also the license work program has obviously been launched and a site survey is planned for Q3 2026. So a little bit of movement on that one. Thoughts on that and on the formal acceptance of the NSTA's license offer?
Yeah, I just think that the reality of the market, as in the retail market, is they don't want to hold till next week. So it seems like a bit too much of an investment as opposed of can I make money straight away. That said, I think a few things could drop in that situation, which would double, treble, quadruple the share price very easily. So, yeah, I've got big holding in it and warrants, etc. So certainly hope it's going to do well.
Yeah, I think biggest mover of the week was Lyft Global, 64%, Empyrean Energy up some 33%, United Oil and Gas up some 27%. One of the shakers of the week, down some 15%, First Class Metals. They announced that the KERS deal closed with an indicative value of 10.64 million. So I think there was quite a lot of chatter on the boards, wasn't there, about this one? Everyone's saying it was a game changer, but the market doesn't seem to have really welcomed it.
Well, I think everybody who believed it was a game changer were the shareholders, and obviously the non-shareholders didn't think it was a game changer. I think the reason why it hasn't gone crazy is because the actual quantum of money that was forwarded to them was, I think, only $160,000. But as a way of unlocking value in assets, and KERS in this case, which is one of the sort of not premium assets, if you like, then I think it's actually fantastic. Will they ever see the $10 million so that they can use it? I hope so. And if they do, then it's going to be beneficial for them. But it's been a lot of pumping, let's say, of that stock over the last few weeks, hasn't it? And that's why, I mean, if you look at the boards, it's constant. And people are, I think people have, a group of people have been switched off because there's been too much. You're like, pump, 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 pump. So, not being good in that respect.
Okay, well, I think we'll wrap up there. We've obviously have a safe journey back to Egypt, Cairo. And obviously next week we're going to provide the update on the 12 stocks, I believe, which will be almost our summer sort of sign-off show for a few weeks.
Yeah, just so everybody knows, we'll have next week, which will be the 12 stock roundup. Then we'll have a show the first week of August. And then we'll be back again the first Sunday of September to start every week again.
Okay. So if you like what you heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon for further notifications of future episode, and have a great weekend all. Come on, England.
Yeah, come on, England.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net